former St Kilda coach and a man who's never been shy of sharing his opinion on the AFL, Grant Thomas. Grant, thanks for joining me on Lace Out.
Always happy to have a chat about our great game.
Honestly, the game's in not that good of a state, is it?
No, well, if you could actually have a camera on me, my nose would be about 2 foot long by now. But, yeah, look, it's definitely got some problems, and they're problems that a lot of people have been talking about for some time. But, unfortunately, the decision makers either aren't listening or they're stubborn or whatever. I don't know the actual root cause of all that, but it just shows what a toothless set of people the commission is as well. I mean, I just for the life of me can't believe that they are accepting all of this stuff going around at the moment. It's quite extraordinary.
It's amazing. I had a chat with Ricky Nixon a number of weeks ago, and he said virtually the same thing you said as well, that it seems to be that they've just completely lost touch with the public, the people who want the game. And is it whether the corporate dollar's taken over or, you know, every time they try to make an aesthetic change or whatever, it just completely does the opposite thing. I think there's been 24 rule changes in the last 5 years. It's just out of control.
Yeah, well, when you get, when you put people with large egos in control of, in controlling positions, these are the sort of outcomes you get, I think. I mean, it requires selfless, humble leadership. I don't think many at the AFL possess those qualities. I think they're more in line with self-perpetuation of careers, bonuses, ego rubs, all that sort of stuff. I don't think that the fan is anywhere near a consideration in any of those decisions. Though they'll say that's not true, but it doesn't, to me, look like it is. And I just don't know what they're trying to do with, they're there to administer the game, and they're already controlling the game by dictating in some ways the outcome with equalisation, which doesn't and shouldn't fit in the same sentence as competition. It's an oxymoron, just can't go. And I'm dead against the equalisation philosophy on things anyway, but they're already controlling the game. They control the clubs. Now they're controlling what the fans have to say. I just think that they're really overstepping their mark, and they're like a puppeteer. They're just, it's like a little toy for them, and they're playing with it in the manner that they want. And look, it's truly a great game. It's the best game on the planet, but I don't think it's getting further away from where it needs to be, from a spectacle and an excitement and a passion and energy and all of those sorts of things. I think it's getting further away. And, you know, the sad thing is I don't think they care. I don't think they're worried about that. They have another agenda, and they'll put it all under the guise of strategic 25-year plans and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it is what it is.
Because I think you were pretty vocal a while ago with Andrew Demetriou, and obviously his sort of pet project into that was Gillon McLachlan. Do you think, has it been the last two people who have been running the game where the downfall or where it is that they has started with those two? Or was it before then, do you think?
Oh, look, I think Demetriou and Gill are the main culprits. I think the club sold themselves. You know, you need to understand history, and I don't think this is where you want to go into it here, but historically the clubs, voted in for what happened in the game. Yep. And unfortunately, because there may have been people in charge at VFL, AFL, let's call it, that might have had better relationships with some clubs, and sub clubs were seen to get better goes than other clubs, and all of that nepotism and everything else that was going on. Yeah. So the clubs got together and said, listen, we need a commission. We need someone in between to actually act in the best interest of all us clubs. as a standalone entity rather than us clubs dealing direct with the AFL or VFL at that stage. And so that power was handed to the commission.
Yep.
But 75% of club votes can actually oust a commissioner or a commission for that matter. And what's happened since is that the AFL have got deals and arrangements with clubs that there's no way known they're going to cross the floor and vote against some things because they can't survive on their own. And so they held the ransom. So all of a sudden, the power shift has been enormous. The clubs are too gutless to stand together, and they're divided, and not just divided in this state, but divided nationally. And that creates a massive problem for fans and for the game, but it creates enormous control and power for the incumbent leaders of the AFL. So that's a nutshell. The history
It is in a nutshell. And I think that one thing that set a lot of people off, and look, I'm a Melbourne supporter, so I'm going to talk about your last game.
I feel sorry for you.
Thanks for it. Oh, look, we're used to it, so it's okay. But one of the things that happened on the weekend was Jeremy Howe took a fantastic mark, leg out, Specky, and gets it turned around for a studs in the back rule. And I think it's almost like the AFL had to come out and say that was the correct decision, knowing 99% of the people out there would say it's completely wrong. Have we just lost completely?
They're just taking the piss. I mean, surely. I mean, every time there's a decision, they come out and say, yes, well, they made the correct decision. I mean, you know, no one takes that seriously. I mean, I think everyone realises that they're just peeing down our backs and telling us it's raining. That's what they do. They just think that it's as long as they can substantiate the decision, everything will go away. It's just ridiculous. But, you know, what other game in the world can have one incident with one ruled as a free kick and another ruled as not a free kick, and it's exactly the same incident, but both of them are correct? Like, there's a substantiation and a rationale as to why a free kick wasn't paid.
Yep.
And there's a rationale and understanding as to why a free kick was paid for exactly the same incident. And you wonder why the game is on a knife edge, because I can't half think that the AFL are orchestrating this because that engenders passion and everything else from the fans. But then again, the fans, are in their words, abusive, and they're starting to throw them out of the stadium. So how about this one for an idea? Instead of employing undercover guards to sort of exit passionate fans out of the stadium, how about fixing up the interpretation or even the rule so that everyone, coaches, players and fans, know exactly for every incident what happens? I mean, it's not difficult. And if it's a touch-and-go situation, how about this for a novel idea? Play on, just let it go. Like,
Why does it have to be interpretation? And I think that's the thing.
Because it gives them an out. You saw last year's grand final. You saw the last play in last year's grand final. It gave them an out.
Yeah.
They could say it was a free kick, and they would be right. And they would say it wasn't a free kick, and they'd be right.
Yep.
The team lost the grand final. A team lost a grand final and a team won a premiership on the back of that decision. Now, both of them are right. So how can that be?
No, it's
ridiculous.
Bewilderment. Like, I played footy for 25 years down in the local leagues and loved every minute of it. And people have said to me, would you think about getting into coaching, et cetera? And, well, there's two reasons. First of all, I know what I did to my coaches over the years. So, A, that's one reason why I wouldn't do it. But you can just see how, like, little knife-edge moments can tip games one way or the other. It must be just, the most rewarding but the most frustrating role that you could have it in any sporting organisation. Like, in your perspective, your last game was the 2006 elimination final, which I was fortunate to be at and my team won. But you got hit by some pretty significant injuries in that game. If you had got over and won that, would you have been at St Kilda the year after in 2007, do you think?
No. I was, it was documented in the paper that the president at the time, said that even if we won the premiership that year, I would have been sacked, which did get my attention at the time. But
is that how you found out about that particular statement, through the paper?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not just through the paper, I mean, also directly, but which I just laughed at the time. But irrespective of that, the last 3 years that I was coaching was, you know, was I was always under that understanding that it was a matter of time because of the situation, which I'm not really interested in talking about.
No, you don't have to. No, I was actually just because you took over from Malcolm Blight that particular year, didn't you? Is that correct? 2006?
Not that year.
No, the year.
2001.
Sorry. 2001. Sorry, 2001. Apologies. But yeah, because Raph Clark went down, Gehrig went down, Clark went down, and you were up with about, I think it was 15 points up with about 6 or 7 minutes to go, and Melbourne overran you. And it was just, it was a fascinating game.
Well,
but yeah,
but the truth of the matter is that we would have cobbled together I'm not going to say average, but a very ordinary, I suppose, group the following week. And as far as we had so many injuries from that game, Rob Harvey did his hamstring in the first half.
Yes.
We had no bench. I think at that stage we were about 32 points up. We were playing very well. Cameron Bruce was tagging halves. Mm-hmm. And we sent halves to the goal square because we said, well, mate, you know, you're cooked next week and can't do anything. And he went to the goal square and played full forward, and Bruce started him for a quarter and a half or so. And then I think about three-quarter time, they realised that Harvey was injured and that we didn't have any bench. And Fraser Gehrig went down, and Hamill went down, I think. Luke Ball, Cozzy, we had a heap.
You had everyone go down that day, yeah, remember. So it was almost like, yeah, you might have won that battle, but next year's war or the next week's war would have been an absolute annihilation because you would have had to play Fremantle over there, I think, if you'd won.
Yeah, we would have dug deep, I suppose, but we would have been without probably 10 or so of our, because we already had probably 3 or 4 of our starting 18 players out for that match.
Yep.
Added to the other 6 or 7 that would have been ruled out, you know, would have had probably 10 of our best dozen not available, or at least 15. And so it would have been a very difficult exercise, but we were always up for the challenge then. And I mean, it's like crying over spilt milk, it's just a fact of life, it is what it is. And I remember walking into the rooms after the game, the coaches all had their heads down, and I'd just done the media, and I'd come back in and I said, guys, lift your heads up. You know, like, it's as good a good coaching and management performance that we've had since I've been here. Like, to be in the circumstances that we were and to have what happened, it was enormous. So, yeah. You know, it was one of our prouder moments, but it, you know, ended up being the end of the road.
Because you had a brilliant group of people at that time. You had Riewoldt, Harvey, Hamill, Gehrig, Del Santo, Goddard, Hudgston, Baker. Do you think that there should have maybe been a flag within that time frame, do you think, for St Kilda, or just not right or not ready?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, like I think that if you're going to talk about all those players, you just need to say, well, were they available or were
exactly.
they not? I mean, we had a cow of a run for a couple of years there, and you know, even like people forget, but Luke Penny, he left in, you know, halfway through season 2005. Now, Luke Penny was as good a defender. He was in All-Australian form and just decided to finish. He just had enough and just stopped. It was just, and it left us in a huge lurch because Max Hudgson was an outstanding fullback, but he was also even better nearly on the small forwards. And
yep.
Luke Penny being there allowed us to do that. And then we lost Luke. You know, you see what happens to Richmond when they take Rants out, you know, like it has an effect. And yeah, you know, look, we had, you know, I know I coached for 123 games and Cozzy and Rui started when I started.
Yep.
I think they played less than 40. I think it was about 36 or 38 games together, Rewalt and Kaczynski.
Is that all? I actually thought, if you speak to a lot of non-St Kilda people, I would have thought it would have been a lot more of that, because it was always, you know, great, because, you know, being a Melbourne guy, oh, great, here we go. Who's it going to be this week, Rewalt or Kaczynski? That's how it always felt, that it was those two, the twin pillars. Like, there was Lloyd and Lucas, there was Kaczynski and Rewalt. But there was only, what, under 50 games that they played together in your time there?
Under 40, I'm pretty sure the figure was 38 or around there that they played together, which was detrimental to us, of course, but as a club. But look, you know, I probably could have coached better. I probably could have been better at different things. I've got no doubt that, and I'd take full account for that period of time. You know, I'm proud of what we achieved, and people don't realise that. We got enormous return from all of those star players, in inverted commas, that ended up being star players under Rossi Lyon as well. Because we got that very early in the piece. Like, they were performing really well as 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds when you aren't expected to be winning premierships with guys that are, you know, 22 and under. I felt that their maturity and their form and their development painted a picture to the general public that probably wasn't necessarily the correct one.
Yep.
You know, I don't think there's any doubt that St Kilda's sweet spot was, we did an enormous effort in 2004.
Yep.
Five, we had a lot of injuries, and six, we had a lot of injuries, but we still won 14 or 15 games in both of those years, which gets you into the top four, and should have been enough to at least snatch one. But we played in two prelims, and both of the teams we played went on to win the premiership the following week. There's Port Adelaide. There was a kick in that over at Port Adelaide.
Yeah,
where,
remember that one?
Yeah, I think we had 19 inside 50s in the first quarter, and kicked four goals four, and Port Adelaide, I think, had about four inside 50s and kicked four goals, and all of their goals came after Fraser kicked his 100th, and the game stopped for 10 minutes, and we were in awesome form and had magnificent momentum, and from that point on, it was a real struggle, and, you know, it was just like an arm wrestle, and having had such ascendancy in the first quarter and only being 4 points in front, I think, you know, it gave confidence to Port Adelaide and may have to fail their guys a bit. I mean, they were enormous that night, but we just failed by a kick. And then the following year, we had Sydney, and, you know, we were about a goal or two up at three-quarter time. And, I think I might have mucked up three-quarter time. I can't remember what I said, but it mustn't have worked. And, we sort of sat away in that game, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So you get to one of those grand finals, you're not a bad chance to win, but the prelims are very difficult to win, and I'm happy to take all responsibility for them.
You know, the thing that you mentioned about Fraser kicking his 100th, do you feel, I'm along these lines, and I want to hear from you, do you think it's a shame now that we're probably never going to see someone kick 100 goals in a season ever again?
Not something that, I mean, I was walking home last night and bumped into Peter Hudson and said g'day, after I left Hutto last night and I kept walking, I was thinking vividly of how he played, and the year he kicked 150 odd and broke Bob Pratt's record or equaled it or whatever,
and I'm thinking Bob Pratt,
150 goals, and then I started thinking about, you know, your Dunstalls and your Lockets and Peter McKenna and all the other guys that kicked 100 goals, and I'm thinking, it was exciting at the time, but, you know, that's not something I hang on to. It's not something now that, like, there's a whole host of other things I prefer in the game rather than seeing an individual kick 100 goals.
What would you prefer? What sort of gets the hairs on the back of your neck standing up when you look at the players running around now?
Well, I like to be on the edge of my seat in a game of footy, and the only way to get someone on the edge of the seat is have a contested footy and have a man-on-man contest.
Yep.
Unfortunately, the game revolves around stoppages, and the game revolves around uncontested possessions, and the game revolves around control of the footy. And I have a very simple solution, and that is if you're tackled and you have the footy, irrespective of how long you've had, instantly or a minute, it doesn't matter, you lose possession of that footy. Now, that makes the playmaker, in some cases, make other decisions, but that's how footy used to be, because 20, 30, 40 years ago, as I remember, if the ball was coming to you and you knew where you were going to get tackled because you were hot in a contested situation, you'd knock it on or kick it off the ground or do whatever. You'd kept the ball alive. Now, it was dangerous. I understand that because it was back into a contested situation. But if you took possession of the footy, there was a fair chance you'd get a free kick against you anyway. And you'd much prefer the ball knocked on, moving in your direction and getting gaining ground. But coaches these days, they go and watch hockey and basketball and soccer and gridiron and everything else, and they come back with harebrained ideas about having nil all draws and kicking sideways and backwards and minding grass rather than opponents. And you have the situation now and a grand final where it's for keeps, and we revert back to the old game, and then a high ball comes into a man-on-man contest and the defender can't defend. He's got no idea how to do it because he hasn't done it before.
Haven't done it for so long.
He's normally minding grass, or he's normally flying third man up across the front. And I just yearn for the big names of footy. And the other thing I think concerns me, and I'm not the sort of person that just sort of says, oh, the good old days. I'm not interested in that at all. I'm more interested in the best product, and the footballers today are just incredibly skilled. The stuff they do at training, the stuff they are able to do in a game is remarkable. And but I don't see enough expression of those skills. I see them playing in structures and strategies and tactics that minimise their abilities and reduces their instinct and their intuitiveness and all the things that they've always, they actually got them to the club.
Which got them there in the first place, yeah. Exactly. So it's almost, they have all this instinct.
And they're frustrated. I talk to a lot of them and they get very frustrated and they say, well, shit, I'd love to do that, but I can't do that because I'm outside of team structure or team rule or guideline. And I don't think that's how footy was supposed to be.
I don't think it was ever meant to be that way. It was supposed to be that any person of any size would be able to pick a position and play it. But what would you prefer? What do clubs look for? Do they look for an athlete they can turn into a footballer because it's such a hard running game, or is it if you're a footballer who's not as quick anymore, do they sort of don't look towards that realm anymore?
I think they're trying to swing back to the footballer because they've got so much ridicule about athletes. But look, the game is basically, on any time in the game, there's usually, 16 midfielders, at least 14 or 15. And you've sometimes got a ruckman, but they haven't even got a ruckman all the time these days. Some idiot tried that 15 years ago and got ridiculed for it. But anyway, we'll move on. And, everyone else is a 6'3", 6'4" midfielder playing, in defence or forward line or between the arcs. And they run 15 kilometres and everything else. But we don't tend to have that those key position players. And the ones that do play, and we have got, there's usually only one of them in a team, sometimes two, but rarely. And it's really exciting watching them go at it. But my greatest frustration is, when 36 players push down to one half of the ground and there's a quick exit from the player, the team's got to wait and wait and wait. And sometimes they kick it over the head and there's a race back to goal. And I just don't think those sort of spectacles are what footy's about. I think footy, people get really excited about that gladiator type, put man on man, kick the ball, kick the ball's kicked to two star players and they fight it out and, best man wins. But I really am convinced that rule about if you're caught with a footy, it's a free kick against you. And that would force teams to act and force teams to... There's no real strategy you can do for that. And that stuffs coaches up. And when it's all said and done, coaches have changed all these rules to secure their own careers because they don't want to have big defeats. They want to keep the game close and they want to control the game.
Yep.
But they've taken the control of the game and the spectacle of the game away from the players, and then it's gone into the coach's box. And that's why we have such low scoring, because coaches always want to know that they're one, two or three goals away and they might be able to pinch the game, but rarely happens.
Yeah, well, the whole tactical side of things has been shifted. Like, I know that the 666 came at the start of the year, and, what's your opinion on 666? Good thing, bad thing, like just another...
I just think it's complete rot,
Yeah.
It's complete rot. I mean, if they had any logic or any courage, they'd just get rid of the centre square. I mean, and they wouldn't even know why the centre square was there. It was a diamond and became a square. But the centre square was there because of the muddy cricket wickets. That's why it was there. You had Kennedy's commandos. That's why it all happened. No one looks into history as to why things happen. No one asks the question why and then why and then why to get to the root cause of things. And it frustrates me because... John Kennedy said, listen, we've got these muddy cricket wickets. We can't get the ball out. Let's get numbers in there. So he used to put half his team in the centre bounce.
And Collingwood's
Hawthorn's commandos used to get the ball out and get it moving forward. So then they said, oh, okay, we can't have that because we've got ugly blue pots in the middle. Let's stick a diamond there, which ended up being a square, to keep people out of the muddy centre square. We don't have cricket wickets anymore. So if you want to have a team that wants to push...
Oh, sorry, mate. My phone just dropped out.
You're going to have a goal kicked against you because you've got those up forward. That, to me, would be marvellous strategy and tactics.
Yeah, Ali.
You there?
Yeah. My phone just dropped out for a sec. Sorry. I agree. They want to fasten the game up, but then they want to slow the game down. Then they want to fasten the game up and then slow the game down. I don't know what they want to do anymore. Oh, I can't keep track. I literally can't keep track.
Who wants to do that? Who wants to do that?
Exactly, you know, that's the question. Who wants to do that? I know as a supporter, I don't want it.
Surely life is all about faster, higher, better.
I just, the whole thing there, you can just run out. Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Hold on, let me just turn
and
this
new
off.
Peanut that comes in as a football manager and...
Yeah, he just wants to change it up. Okay, so let's just not have to kick it to ourselves and we kick out a fullback anymore. Actually, let's slow the game down so we'll take the rotations away. It's just too much change.
Oh, well, I don't know what their rationale or reasoning is behind it, but, I gave the example of the centre square, and to me it's just a flawed model, it's the 666. I don't understand the rationale. I just don't understand it. It's people come in and they get on a golf committee and they put a bunker in and they walk past with their guests and say, I put that there. Well, that's not the logic or rationale to make a change in football. The credibility and the integrity of a sport is more about a fact that it's untouched and remains the same for generations and generations. Now, I understand things need to be tweaked, but I just don't understand the logic around it. It's like it's trying to shape the game to be a better spectacle, and yet you are minimising the chances of it being a spectacle. The harder you try to open the game up and make it a spectacle, the harder the coaches get in the war room and have a conflicting strategy or tactic to minimise it. So it's a no-win situation. The more you try and open the game up and make it a spectacle, the more coaches will shut it down to control it.
Yeah.
So you're not going to win that. So why try? And I just think it's insane of people in the AFL to think that they can do it. I don't know what conversations they have with coaches. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when Gary Hocking, or whatever, sorry, Steve Hocking,
yep,
goes and interviews all the coaches about the new rules he wanted to implement. And they'd be sitting there saying, oh, yeah, Steve, that sounds like a great idea. Oh, that'd be good, Steve, yeah, fantastic. What a great initiative. Steve walks out with his chest beating and head up and thinking, oh, I'll make this magnificent change to the game. And the coaches walk back inside and say, Jesus Christ, is he serious? we're just going to do this and we're going to do that, and they're not going to matter anyway.
And they don't think they're serious, and then they roll out, and it's just like, well, what are we going to do now? I'd
been
be
a
stunned.
Change in scoring, hasn't it?
Oh, it's made a difference on one game this year, which was the Gold Coast Melbourne game. That was the only time you could sit back and go, "Yep, that was perfect."
There you go.
But that's it. One game. No
but anyway,
trial.
What would I know? I mean, I can only apply logic and common sense to these things.
No, I know you know a lot, because one thing I have to quickly ask you, I do want to ask you about, is that one reason I used to watch Footy Confidential every week was to hear you, because I felt that you said what everybody else was, in my eyes, thinking. Did you enjoy your time on the show? And then, you know, obviously, you finished up a couple of years back. Did you enjoy having that round table banter, or were you still restricted to a certain degree?
Well, surprisingly, I did enjoy it because, you know, I reconnected with Caro, who I had a bit of an estranged relationship with, but that didn't worry me. I was happy to get in there again with her, and we learnt to sort of have a bit of respect for each other, and I sort of got to know her more, and you know, I hold her in very high regard, much higher regard than most other journalists I know, for the work she does, and her integrity and the way she goes about it. I think so that was a good thing. It was great working with Kaz, Gary Lyon. He was good fun, Gaz, and you know, I think he's a real deep thinker of the game, and good to have. You know, I used to have some fantastic debates and discussions with Gaz off camera sometimes, and that was enjoyable. I didn't enjoy. There came a time where they told me to zip up and not say anything about umpires, or not say anything about the AFL, or not say anything about Andrew Demetrio. I think Demetrio threatened legal action against me or the show a couple of times, and I just said, fine, let him go. You know, he gets in the witness box first. I have to ask him the questions. We'll see what the truth is. But they didn't want to bar of that, and they're all compromised because of the football rights and the deals. And you know, Jeff Brown is a great guy. Brown is closely connected with the AFL and Demetrio, and he's not going to want to go against his mate. And they brought me in and said, hey, listen, you have to apologise. I'm not apologising. I told the truth. It's the truth. So I'm not apologising. So that night they opened up with Gary Lyon apologising. So I thought that was the time. Around 21, I said, that's it, I'm out. I'm, you know, if you want a puppet to say what you want, you can pay much less and just get some peanut here to fill him full of lines, and he can say what you want him to say. That's fine, but it's not what I want to do. So,
is that why you like Twitter? Because you're very vocal on Twitter, and like I said, a lot of the stuff that I've read that you've written is, you know, what I think and what a lot of the fans think as well too. Is that because you don't have to have that filter applied, and it's instant interaction with the supporter or somebody else who can throw out a comment and you go, hold on a second, no, or where's this coming from?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of components to it. I mean, you know, SEN was the other thing that I was, the AFL put pressure on them to get me sacked because of what I was saying. The AFL were involved in the Channel 9 thing. Caro, when I fell out at The Age, she didn't like something was said. So I just couldn't be bothered with all that. You know, as I kept saying to people, hey, listen, if it's not true, don't worry about it. And if it is true, do something about it. Yeah. So it's pretty simple. And what I like about Twitter now is, hey, I'm not interested in the media career or doing any of that stuff, but that's why I enjoy the podcast as well, because, you know, you can voice your opinion and say what you think, and Twitter is, to me, the best vehicle in that regard, because you're engaging directly with fans. I consider myself just a footy fan now. That's all I am, no different than anyone else.
Yeah.
That follows me or I talk to, and I try and respond to everyone. I give them respect because they deserve it, because they're interested, and I couldn't care less what they say about me. It doesn't worry me. It doesn't concern me. I've never blocked anyone. I never will. I have some people who try very, very hard, but that's okay. It's a lot in life, and they're obviously hiding behind a a banner of being someone else that they're trying to have a crack at me, but that's okay. Yep. That's all fun. I don't really worry about any of that. And I just think the footy fans like to engage with banter on the real issues of footy, and I enjoy that.
And I think the accessibility of it, and you're right, there's not that filter or that wall between you and somebody else. So as an example, I wrote to all 18 clubs at the start of the year just saying, hey, listen, got the podcast lace out. If you've got any players who want to have a quick chat, you know, 10, 15 minutes, et cetera, and so forth, you know, here's my details, love to hear from you, et cetera. And one replied, 17 didn't. Yet I've sent out a couple of messages. I spoke to yourself. I spoke to Ricky Nixon. I spoke to Justin Charles a number of weeks ago, et cetera. And all it was just a message out going, hey, listen, this is what I'm all about. If it's something that you want to do, great. If you don't, you know, thank you for your time, sort of thing. And in all cases, it's been, yeah, happy to have a chat. And so it's almost that you can just have that one-on-one. And by the way, I did get in contact with Sam as well too. And his response was, let me just have a think about this, why I'd want to do this. So you can get back to him and say, yeah, Mr. Newman, I actually got in before you. Next time you catch up with him. But like, just to be able to sit here and have just a casual chat about, you know, people's thoughts on footy, that means a lot to me. And it means a lot to supporters who are going to listen to that to go, like, actually, you know, I believe it just puts people in a different light, and just feels that, you know, from the official perspective, which is what a lot of people try to go down, you just, unless you've got some big ratings behind you or a big name, they don't want to deal with you at all.
It's a fact of life. It's pretty much a closed shop. It's a boys' club in that regard, and a lot of nepotism, as we all know. But the benefit of Twitter is that you know fans can engage with anyone, you know, current coaches, current administrators, not that you'd want to, players, everyone, and have some banter. And I would suggest that 90% of it's respectful. Might be agreeable, but it's respectful.
Yeah.
And it's probably more than that. There's only a very small percentage that's, abusive or, rude or off the charts or whatever. But, you know, I love footy fans. I love engaging with them, and I love just having a general chat, and it makes their day better and it makes my day better. And we talk about some of the real issues, and we get a cross section of ideas as to why something's working or why something's not. That's a healthy thing I see. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, you're negative. I'm not negative. I just like to talk about the things that confuse me or the things that concern me. And there's enough media outlets, rubbing AFL players' tummies or bubbling up to the AFL administration and telling their good news stories. And so, you know, I don't think I need to do that. I don't need to say what a fantastic mark or, you know, whatever. But I'm more interested in talking about the things that I know, footy fans standing at the bar having a drink, you know. The lady might say this or the man might say that. Well, that's the sort of stuff I want to talk about on Twitter.
Oh, that's beautiful. And you're exactly right. There is a difference between negative and honest. And you know, my dad always said, Chris, you don't always have to agree with someone's opinion, but just always respect it. And so I think that's what the good thing about it is that, you know, we can say, look, I don't agree with that, or I do agree with that. But if you do that at a commercial level, it seems to be that if you agree with it, great. If you don't, well, we're going to have a chat about it.
And that's the other good thing about Twitter. It's not a commercial thing, you know. It's not... I know, even though in the podcast that, you know, the guys were pretty keen to commercialise that, and they had me the whole time. But as soon as you do things like that, you actually compromise yourself.
Yep. Yeah, the bit of the integrity goes exactly why you started up in the first place. Wholly agree. Look, I've got to ask you about a couple of players, if you don't mind. Now, one who I actually consider probably one of the best small forwards to ever play the game, and his record speaks for itself, is Stephen Milne. So what was he like to coach? Like, was he a frustrating guy? Was he a great guy? Was he one of those players that you'd love him one minute and him hate him the next? I think from the whole St Kilda perspective, he was the one guy that, and Nick Rewald I'll ask about in a moment, but he was the one that just fascinated me the most from a St Kilda perspective.
I loved all the players, irrespective. It's just... You know, we're connected and we're committed, and Milnie was no different. Loved him, still love him. Talked to him reasonably regularly, and you know, he's was an incredibly coachable guy. He all ears, wanted to learn, listened, and very attentive, fantastic team spirit person, great camaraderie guy, would do anything for his teammates on field or off field. He just loved his teammates, loved them. You know, it was his family, and he was an incredibly strong personality within the group. Very humorous, lighten the levity of the room pretty easily. He was frustrating early days in as far as he didn't quite understand some of the things that we wanted from him. He was a little bit too hit and miss, trying to rely and depend on his ability, and he didn't understand the concept of the numbers game, that if the amount of contests you attend is a direct correlation to the amount of success you have. If he had a day where he attended 8 contests, 2 a quarter, and kicked 4 goals, he'd be walking off really happy. And I say, well, mate, 8 contests, turn that into 20, then you can come and talk to me, go to 5, go to 10, go to as many as you can, because you tend to win at least half of them. So, and he didn't get that for a while, but his penny dropped, I think. And he also, early days, he was sort of getting in the way a hell of a lot, whether it be of Nick or Aaron or Fraser, Cozzy. He was sort of right in the middle, but that was just his desperation to try and be involved. But when he understood the system that we were trying to apply, he improved dramatically there. And, I think Ross topped him off really well and brought some other fine edges to him also. But I love Milne. He's a ripper.
You're a ripper. What about now, do you love, everybody loves Lenny Hayes. Did you love him as much as the general public out there? Or was there a bit of a side to Lenny Hayes that, not many people saw, that he actually did, he did have a bit of a black mark against him? Or was he just, what you saw is what you get?
Look, what you saw is what you got with Lenny. I mean, he was just a beautiful, beautiful person. He's the sort of person that you would love your daughter to walk through the, into the house with. He's a cracker. Incredible humility, selflessness, honour, integrity. Just reeked of all of that. And just everyone loved him, and you can't help but love him, Lenny, and that's just how he was. But he was a beast on the field. His courage and bravery was unprecedented. He was, just an enormous, enormous player, and just, I was very honoured to be a part of his career.
Is Brendan Goddard always an angry man? steely determination. Or is he just a passionate guy?
He's just BJ is very passionate, and he doesn't suffer fools, and he doesn't accept mediocrity, and he just he thinks if it's worth doing something, you do it properly. And that's probably why he's turned his hand to golf really well, because it's a real detail evaluative game, and he's very, very good at that. But God, he'd laugh his head off, he'd crack jokes, he'd be all of those sorts of things. But when it was serious and it was time, he wore his heart on his sleeve, and he was demanding higher performances and everything else, and he was very passionate and energetic and outspoken and all those sorts of things. But I thought all that was good as well. It's a just good mix of personalities. I mean, I became a doctor of human personality. Watch all the guys, and they're all different, and that was a beautiful thing.
Is that what coaches are these days, with all the assistants around them now? It's that people, the head coach becomes more of a people manager, guider, rather than the way that coaches were 20 odd years ago?
Oh, well, I'd have to understand what you thought the coaches were 20 years ago, but this day and age, I see coaches, I see them as being incredibly tactical, strategic, I don't see a lot of entrepreneurial flair. I don't see a lot of bravery and leadership. You see a bit of it, and usually they're the successful ones. But what I don't understand is the enormous amount of coaches that are just learning on the job. They've never coached before. They've been an assistant coach, and they get appointed, and they're learning on the job. And everyone says, oh, yeah, someone has to do that. Well, you don't have to. I mean, that's why I give credit to, you know, some of the coaches who have coached before, because you've got to have actually done it. And these guys are deprived of life skills and learning because they've only ever been involved in a footy club. They've left school at 18, and next thing they're an AFL club on a minimum of 100 grand a year, and probably it goes up to nearly $1 million a year, and for 15 years, and then they go and become an assistant coach for 3, 4, or 5 years, and then you hand the keys to the 50 players and 100 staff and say, go and do it. Like, it's insane. It's just insane. I don't get it, but it is what it is. And the other mistake they make is when someone's a highly talented assistant coach, and I think there's many examples around at the moment. If someone's a highly talented assistant coach, well, they're brilliant at minutiae, they're brilliant at detail, they're brilliant at statistics, they're brilliant at teaching and education and all those sorts of things, because that's what floats their boat.
Yep.
Whereas a senior coach usually is a great leader, a great innovator, a great entrepreneur, and great visionary, great people person. And so they're diametrically opposed skills, but too many times we pick these great development coaches out, or great tactical coaches out, or great, detailed sort of assistant coaches out. And we say, oh shit, he knows what he's saying. He knows the words, and he talks up a really good game. And he does a really good job with the midfield or the defence.
Yep.
And they make him senior coach, and I don't get that. I don't understand that.
So what would you do? Would you? Because I don't know. I wouldn't know how to solve that. Because, you know, you look at someone like Brendan Bolton, who seemed to be a really good assistant coach through Hawthorn's days, etc. Mind you, he was under Clarke, who's probably been the most innovative coach in the last 20-odd years. But then he goes and takes over Carlton, and then a couple of weeks, a couple of years later, he's sitting next to, and it was probably one of the most painful press conferences I've got, where he actually had to sit next to the president and listen to all the reasons why they had to get rid of him. Like, from an ex-coach's perspective, do you sit there and just go, like, you can get your life back again? Or, because you probably won't get another senior gig. It's almost like if you fail the first time, they're really reluctant to bring you back for a second chance.
I think it's a second chance, and I think he's a good coach, and I think he's coached very well in his own right in Hobart or whatever, and I think he also did another coaching gig in the VFL or whatever he did, but he's a student of the game. He's an educator and a teacher. He's in the same vein as Clarkson. I just can't accept. I think he probably got a few things wrong. I think he probably had a few people offside. He probably could have done things a bit better if he had his time again. But I've got no doubt he can be an astute coach and cut the mustard. And when you consider the two of the previous coaches at Carlton, Dennis Pagan, and they got the flip. It just probably goes to tell you that they may not have got it right. You know, maybe they should look more at the people running the club rather than the people coaching the club, because maybe I'm not Mick Malthouse's favourite, but Dennis Pagan is probably, along with Robert Walls, is probably the two best coaches I had ever had anything to do with. So, Dennis is an outstanding coach, and I just got the shock of my life when they didn't persevere with him. He's exactly what they needed, but he's just too strong, too hard.
Yeah. And that's the thing these days, isn't it? Like, when I was saying that what coaching was around about 20 years ago, you might have had the head coach and maybe a couple of support figures next to him. I remember the old school days, looking up at the MCG coach's box, and the box wouldn't have been too much bigger than a bus shelter. And there'd be the senior coach and probably maybe one, if not two, assistants. And now they've got this massive, massive
cast
suite.
Of Ben-Hur.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And that cast of Ben-Hur, that eight coaches have all got to find an opportunity to have their meeting and their drills and that all during the week. And you wonder why players are bored shitless and aren't enjoying any of their week these days. It's just insane. And don't even start me on them talking about making the umpires full-time. I mean, I don't believe the players should be at the club the amount of time they currently are. I just think it's overkill. The time that they're at the club and the amount of meetings and the amount of stuff they've got to go through, they just want to play footy now. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have any of that, but, you know, I think that this stuff about getting them there very, very early and they're leaving late and they've got meetings and they've got a two-hour block in the middle where they haven't got anything. It's not enough time to go to the game of golf. It's not enough time to go and do anything, really. And then they've got to be back in another massage session or weight session or whatever. And I just find that their whole program is not conducive to enjoyment and betterment. I think it's very frustrating for a lot of the players, or all the players I happen to bump into and speak to, not just Saints players, a lot of other players from other clubs, and they don't enjoy it, but they just don't like it.
But they haven't got, they can't really say anything either about it. What are they going to say? Look, I don't want to turn up this meeting. Well, you're not going to hear any longer.
I'm a highly paid professional, so I do what I'm told, but... If a coach said, okay, well, you guys are going to run the program this year, I'll tell you what, it'll be much different to what they're getting.
Yeah, no, definitely. One thing, just before we wrap up, one thing I wanted to quickly ask you about is that you've also mentioned the gambling side of things, and how I think one of the things that was like how the AFL, once the AFL sort of started taking the corporate dollar from the gambling companies, that was pretty much the end of it. Obviously you've heard your stories and you don't have to go into it because you are a lot closer to people out there, but is it that much of a challenge for players? Yeah. Problem would probably be the word I'm looking for. Yeah. Then do people really know what the players are going through? Cause I'm tipping that there'd be some serious trouble.
Well, when you consider drugs and gambling, it probably adversely affects over 100% of the players. And you're saying, how the hell can that happen? Well, I reckon if 60-70% of players take illicit drugs, and if 60-70% of players are gambling. Well, that to me says there's about 120% of players affected by things that I don't think we manage all that well.
Yeah,
I haven't got the solution. I haven't got the answer, apart from being a bit stronger and a bit more strict with the ramifications. I don't care if there's a couple of sacrificial lambs who lose their careers. Just to send a message, but players are getting a message of, too many opportunities. And I just think with the gambling one at the moment, I don't think the message is right from the AFL. I remember Andrew Demetrio saying, oh, we have to have these relationships so that we can get information from them. I thought it was a really piss week then, and it sounds even worse now.
Well, it's a crock when you've got a club who has the Neds across the front of their jumper, and I was on Twitter the other day, and I was like, well, how many of those players do you think, or do you reckon each of the players would have got a betting account as part of the sign up? Now apparently they can't bet in games, but you'd think that there would have been. Yeah,
but the AFL, you know, they've got a significant sponsorship with gambling entities, and it just sends the wrong message. You can't sort of entertain those relationships and then say that, oh yeah, by the way, you shouldn't do that. You know, it's sort of it doesn't send the right message.
It doesn't send the right message when kids these days. Even with my wife, with the footy tips that we're involved in, she might even throw like, who's playing? Oh, Melbourne, and it won't be who's got the better teams. Who's the favourite? Like that, even the vernacular around how we describe who's the better team is who's got the better odds or who's the favourite. That's a substantial shift. And then once start kids talking about, you know, who's got the better odds or how many points in, then you know you're in some serious trouble.
Yeah, it's a massive problem.
But, it's a tough one.
You know, the AFLPA, I don't think do anywhere near enough. They're usually jumping out after the fact and saying, "Oh, hang on a minute, no one spoke to us." Well, you know, I see danger up and down about a few things, but you know, you'd want them to. They don't have to be Einstein. They're at the coalface. They know exactly what the issues are with players, and I'm just not certain they're taking a significant enough stance and are prepared to make the harder calls or ask the AFL to put in place more stringent guidelines that might make players think. And a lot of people say, "Oh, well, you know, society today doesn't see that as a deterrent." Well, okay, well, we've tried everything else and it hasn't worked. So let's see if it is a deterrent.
Yep.
Let's see if an 18, 19, you know, 18, 19, 20 year old wants to, you know, compromise his 10-year, you know, $500,000 a year football contract for making one silly social decision by way of drugs or gambling.
Yeah,
it's got to make them think, and it would actually support the programs put in place by clubs and PA and AFL. Because at the moment it's contradictory for both of them.
Yeah, and I think just from the AFL's perspective, it's when you got this two strike rule, and the clubs don't even find out, and they want to help their players, etc., but they don't even find out. It's a challenge. It is a challenge.
It's a big challenge.
Well, the one question I when I was doing a bit of a look and a bit of research about yourself, one of the things that struck me after reading everything that's happened is that you're a father of 8 kids. Is that correct?
Correct.
Correct. How did you do everything? And I've got 2 of my own, and I find that as a challenge. How did you do everything that you've done and also have to be a father to 8 kids and a husband as well?
Well, I'm probably not the world's best husband. I'm probably not the world's best father. But one thing I can lay claim to is I do have the most amazing wife on the planet. And she is the one that had to do all of the hard yards. And, you know, we have a pretty set guidelines at our place. If it's inside the house, it's Keza. And if it's outside the house, it's me. And play your part well, therein lies the glory. And she's just a superstar. Like, she has enormous patience, understanding, caring. And I would approach a lot of the stuff with the kids differently to her, but it works. And she's Mother Teresa. I mean, she's just an amazing woman. And the rock and the Gibraltar for the family, and an enormous fillip of inspiration and courage and bravery that I'm able to do for certain things that I do in life, because if I didn't have that, I wouldn't even attempt it. So no. You're right, but she's the unsung hero, of course, because you know, she makes sure that the 8 children have been able to grow up in a reasonable manner, and
yep.
I don't have to do all the things that necessarily a father would have to do, and or a husband would do. So, it's been a bit of a selfish life in that regard, but yeah.
Oh, they make us better people. They make us better people. That's fantastic. Yeah. Now, your podcast, are you still rolling on with Sam, Mike and Tomo, or is that still, what's the
lay
of the
land of that? No. Look, something might pop up down the track, but that's all finished for now.
That's a shame, though, because that had to do something with, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but that shut down because was it something that Mike said, or Mike had a little bit of, there was something that went wrong with Mike, and unfortunately,
there was a well-documented incident that occurred, and from that, Mike resigned from that pretty well the following day, straight away, and that just left the two of us, and we sort of taken a couple of weeks off, and Sam and I, and we've sort of never really got it going again, and we just sit and wait, and they might do something down the track, we might not, but he might do something, and it might involve me, and I might do something that might involve him. But, you know, I enjoy doing the podcast, and
that's good.
As long as there's someone that's interested in what you got to say,
Trust me, I'm one who's definitely had a lot to say. Look, just before we follow up and close up in a moment, outside of obviously the football and having a chat to, you know, awesome podcast hosts like me, etc., what also takes up Grant Thomas's time, business wise, etc.?
Well, I've run a technology company for how long? For about 12 years,
Yep.
and have a business partner, Dom, who we've been together for about that long, and we built Bendigo Bank's banking platform, and we have just launched Australia's first digital bank called Up, and just clicked over 100,000 customers.
Congratulations.
The first 8 or 9 months, and it's going exceptionally well. We're really proud of it, and technology-led banking, so there's a very significant twist in the customer experience.
Yep.
And but you know, we're loving it, and that keeps me busy during the day. And I've got an amazing team of 35, 40 staff who are just brilliant at what they do, and it's given me a completely new insight into the last 10 or 12 years when you've been involved in sport and everything else, and you see nerds at computers building code and what they're able to achieve and do. They're superstars themselves. So really enjoy it, and yeah, hopefully do it for at least another decade.
I hope so. And congratulations, because I've got it up in front of me now. So it's Superpowered Banking. That's incorrect. Superpowered Living and Up. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well for yourself. But last but not least,
Beautiful.
thank look, all I've got to say is thank you very, very much for your time. I know I've taken more than enough of your day, so I really appreciate that. But just people like yourself that just tell it how it is. A lot of us out there in the football public world who'll never have the insight to what you do, we really appreciate that. And I know you're probably going to say I'm not, but just don't change, because it's refreshing. And there's 27, you've got 27,000 followers on Twitter, and that's no doubt going to grow. And we'll keep reading if you keep writing it. And you know, I'm appreciative. Thank you from myself and the rest of the Lace Out audience.
Happy to be here and keep up the great work,
I
and
will.
always connect with the fans. They're the
I
most
will.
important people in the game.
Appreciate it. And Grant Thomas, thank you very much.
All the best.
Have a
Catch ya.
wonderful day. Take care. Bye-bye.